May I address a question to the last speaker? And I apologise, I can't pronounce his name. Goran, Professor Goran. Okay. His smart meter idea seems to be a very good one, but would a halfway stage be something similar to the white meter, which used to be popular at one time, but now seems to have been abandoned largely? I can also see some difficulties with it because although I allow my wife to do the washing in our house, I do study some of the things that she does. And halfway through the washing procedure, there's a transfer from the washing machine to the tumble dryer. Now, the tumble dryer is the one which uses the most energy, and consequently, I don't think she'd be prepared to leave it till the following day or following night to do it. So there are some issues there. But my main issue is about the white meter. Would it be a good idea for the government to introduce something like that again, or is that not a halfway stage to your smart metering?
Thank you. I'll take another couple of questions there, and then perhaps we'll come to the panel after we do some three at a time. So up there, please.
I seem to recall an Institute for Manufacturing, Cranford University, study a few years ago talking about daylight saving, or rather not. I seem to be getting up an hour later these days, i.e. at the same time, but the clocks have moved. And I seem to recall something like 4 or 5% of UK energy bill could be wiped out by getting up at a more normal time and coming home when the lights are still on, rather than having to, are still off using daylight, rather than actually having to turn all the lights on. In other words, I'm quicker to leave the house than I am to return. And my second question actually concerns, we've heard a lot about certain renewables. It seems to me the wind blows from time to time, and actually hanging the washing out might be an answer to drying it rather than using a tumble dryer. But I actually wonder whether or not the tidal energy of the Severn Estuary has actually been looked at and contrasted with other opportunities. I think it happens every day. Thank you.
And third comment over there.
I'm surprised if the number of appliances that you could run throughout the night was significant enough. I mean, yes, washing machines, dishwashers, but all the things that you want to do, such as heating or hairdryers or cooking, would make up a significant proportion. So I'd be interested in your answer on that.
Thank you. So three and a half questions there. Perhaps the comments from the panel. Goran, should we start with you?
Yeah, I can start with the... The difference between smart meter and white meter, if I'm correct, was asked John. The key issue in here is that we need to link the wholesale market and the retail market. Currently, they are decoupled. So when wind is blowing, it is Sunday, this is not reflected. So we would need to have much more dynamic system. And so having ahead of time completely all this sorted out is not going to produce what we want to produce in here. So the smart meter, what we want to see, and there's lots of, in fact, opposition to this, that what we say, we need to link the wholesale market and the retail market. That's the whole point of smart meters, so that, you know, in terms of deregulation, when the industry was privatized, you know, the fundamental idea behind that was that users, by making choices, will drive the industry. That's the whole point of the market. You know, if you buy, Apple, everybody, then So by making choices, and the smart meters is the holy grail, if you like, of this deregulation. And we are concerned that the present vision is that this is still not going to actually enable us to make these decisions. So we think that smart meters are absolutely key. And again, if we decide we can't be bothered, no problem. Our bills from £25 billion per annum are going to go to more than £40 billion per annum. And if we are happy to pay for that, that's our choice across the board.
Peter.
Question of the Severn Estuary. The government actually commissioned a very significant report in 2008-09. Spent a large amount of money doing a very thorough report, and the report, the decision eventually was that on balance it was not going to go ahead with the scheme at that stage. But it was written in a way, a very professional report, and it was written in a way that would allow a future government to make that decision to go with the Cardiff Western, probably, barrage, because there are very positive benefits associated with that. It would give you 5% of the nation's electricity from a single scheme. The difficulties are that the Habitats Directive, because it's a Ramsar, it includes Ramsar sites, SPA and SACs, the difficulties are the Habitats Directive require there would be a replacement, there would need to be a replacement of the seven estuary affected, area affected times 2.5 elsewhere to provide wading bird habitats, which is clearly ridiculous because you would have to displace a habitat where you put the replacement habitat. So you end up in a completely circular argument. So we either derogate from the Habitats Directive and go ahead with the seven scheme, because it would be a very significant contributor from a single generation capacity, which is very low carbon, with a very long life. And you would still have tidal movement in the estuary, but it would be disrupted from where you've got it now. So you would probably get wading birds that would probably be different. The interesting dilemma, the environmental dilemma, is that if you don't do it, you exacerbate climate change and the environment within which those wading birds operate is already changing year on year. And if you do it, you contribute to an improvement in climate change conditions, and you then end up with a different population of wading birds and a different ecology. So the environmental impact would be significant, but you wouldn't end up with a desert. You would end up with a different natural environment. But you would have to derogate from the Habitats Directive, which would be a very significant move.
John, do you want to comment?
And I would just add to that last comment, all of which I agree with. There's also the question of how much it would cost. And one of the issues whenever you do the studies, and I've got to say in my career, I think I've seen six seven barrage cycles of interest, and they all fall down on the cost. So we can do it. It would be doable in an acceptable way, but the problem is there have always been cheaper options. I'd like to very briefly answer the question about thinking about daylight saving time. Yes, if we shifted our clocks, we could make some savings in energy consumption. We have tried it before. There was resistance to it for other social impacts. There was concern about children going to school in the dark, increased traffic accidents and many other things. It would bring about a saving, but we need to look at the balance of social impact and economic impact and energy impact to work out whether it's a good thing to do. But yes, if we shifted the clocks, we would automatically save energy. And then finally, I'd just like to pick up the lady's point over here about the usability of demand shifting. And I'm doing a segue to Goran here so that he can disagree with me again. But I think that you raise a very valid point. And the valid point is, like Goran, I'm an engineer. I've spent my career as an engineer. And we can think up all kinds of fantastic schemes, few of which survive first contact with human beings. And I think that one of the things that you've raised is a very good point, which is about the fact that we can think of ways of making our usage balance the system needs more effectively. The question is, does that meet our social needs and our lifestyle needs as we go forward? And I think that is something that we will come across when these systems are deployed. But tell me why I'm wrong, Goran.
No, it's, I agree with this. I just mentioned this. There is, in terms of what appliances are being used in here, currently just only wet appliances. But there is also very big interest in potentially making transport sector, which will be more low carbon, and also heat sector, which will be more low carbon. And there is, in those sectors, there is a potentially massive difference or massive opportunity to have the flexibility. Yeah. And absolutely, you know, this is all fine in terms of how far we want to go to this. But as I say, what will be useful, why this is important, because now the difference in the total value of that is going to increase more than 30 times over it's now, and we are anyway rolling out smart meters. We just should make sure that our consumers are allowed to have that choice. And let's say if they make that choice, the difference between the bill of consumers who can't be bothered, who can, versus who are offering flexibility, but there is no compromise on service quality. All your shirts and socks are ready when you need them, and all your champagne glasses are ready when you need them, yeah? But the difference in bills is 3:1 ratio. And if we decide we can't be bothered, no problem. I'm not saying this will happen. But what I'm saying, we must allow users to actually make that choice, because difference in bills is going to be massive. And that's where we are, that's where I think the biggest challenge is for the government and for the regulator to make sure that is, we are rolling out smart meters, and if we don't allow this, we're wasting billions of putting these smart meters of actually not being used for the whole point of it, which is to allow consumers to make choices.
I might just add, I've got a paper in publication at the moment looking at Japan in the 3 years that it's been doing without nuclear, and there's been some, they seem to have managed to reduce demand by about 15% and peak demand by about 20% from a variety of measures that are very much consumer driven, and there clearly is capacity there if people feel there's a real reason for doing it. It's getting over that psychological barrier which having to import vast amounts of expensive fossil fuels does, but climate change doesn't in terms of motivation.
Interesting point from Goran of supply being decoupled from demand and using the idea of smart options to reduce energy consumption. It seems also there's a point of since you've got generation when we don't need it, cost-effective energy storage, such as Electric Mountain in Wales that you mentioned. I hope I misheard if you said that it was 25% of the energy was wasted in Electric Mountain, which is actually shocking. Is there any way of storing energy or any work being done on storage of energy that would fill that gap so we could use renewables without, so it could be coupled to demand? And storage, an energy buffer would be useful. Is there any research being done on that?
I understand that electric cars move the carbon emissions from the exhaust pipe to the power station, but actually don't change the amount of carbon emission. And they also cost the carbon emission of making all the batteries and replacing them every 5 years. Is there any point to having electric cars from a carbon emission point of view?
Holland, I believe, or one of the Scandinavian countries, they don't allow you to use your washing machine on social hours. Because of the noise to your neighbours. It's like the Germans not letting you mow your lawn on a Sunday. A lot of European countries also have central facilities. The less people have their own washing machines, they use the facilities of laundrettes and stuff. And I can't remember the last time I saw a laundrette around here. Can we think about the way the Europeans are handling demand for this sort of energy? And the second part of it is with night storage heating, for those of us that aren't on the gas grid, are there any plans to increase the sustainability of that, how effective it is, to make it more controllable and more usable for us? Because that's effectively using the energy in a smart way, it's just not very efficient, and my house is really, really warm in the mornings.
John, do you want to go first on?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. I'll stray upon all those subjects if I can. First of all, control of usage. It sounds like it must be Switzerland or Germany to me, saying that you can't mow the lawn or you can't do this on certain days. I think that having some kind of blanket control of that form probably is not going to be the route that a British government might choose. For the reasons of difficulty of enforcement and the fact that it would be perceived as an unwarranted intrusion into individual lives. So I think that's one of the things that we might not see. There was a question about night storage. Is anything being done to make them more controllable?
Yes, and in fact, something was done 30 years ago to provide an electrically heated pile of very, very well insulated bricks that plugged into a conventional heating system. I was around when that was being developed and put on the market, and it worked quite well. It fell out of usage because it didn't become economically attractive, because it was probably twice the purchase price of a straight gas boiler. And if you could buy a gas boiler, you did. And therefore, it was a restricted market. The volume didn't enable the cost to come down all that well, and it proved difficult to sustain as a commercial product. The issue overall is the effectiveness of thermal insulation. That's the real problem with all this. And needs to go. There was then the question about storage. Well, there's an enormous amount being done on storage. The question is, what will it produce? And we don't know the answer to that. And then finally, electric cars. You raise a very valid point. Where does the energy come from for a battery-driven, because that's what you're really saying, a battery-driven car. And I think that it's not only where does the energy come from, because you're quite right. If you do what's called the well-to-wheels analysis of the emissions from a battery car, and you assume that you've got a mixed electrical generation system of the type that we have, frankly, it doesn't make very much difference. But the underpinning theory is that as the electricity supply is progressively decarbonized, then it will make a substantial difference. However, what I would like to do, and this is my little pet thing, call them battery cars, please, because I am convinced that as we move forward, more and more of automobiles will have electric drive systems on. The question is where the electricity comes from. They could be hybrids, they might be fuel cells, they could be hydrogen driven, they may have batteries. There's a whole range of things, but I think increasingly we will see that the technology of turning the wheels will be electric. Because there are all kinds of advantages in doing that. So that's my view on all of those. You see, I'm opinionated, so I can say anything. But I'll let the others talk about it.
Peter.
I only wanted to comment on smart meters, really, and I think it'll be very good when they appear. Because so far, the attempts at smart meters are engineer-driven, and they are supplier-driven, and they are as unfriendly and as inaccessible to consumers as you could possibly imagine. So we've devised technologies which are brilliant but utterly confusing to the consumer. And until we get that, I hate the phrase, but until we get that socio-technical bit much better sorted out, we're not going to be able to make these gains. All the gains that are available, which Corin has made so eloquently, are there, but you have to do this in a... You can't do this in a regulatory way. You have to do it in a consumer-sensitive way. The probably the greatest effect on our lives in the last 25 years has been the internet. Thank God governments were not involved at any stage, because we would have had something that was completely inaccessible or wasteful. It was entirely, and mobile telephony in much the same way. When we come with an advancement, as engineers, we have a significant responsibility to make sure that they are, that the advancements are understood, accessible, and appealing to the consumers. Otherwise, it's just going to be a failed idea.
Goran, do you want to add anything?
To this, I mean, the storage is, there is a huge amount of... activities going on in storage, and the costs look to go down. Excuse me. That there are some technologies which are already now commercially viable. They already would be useful, but there is, as I say, huge amounts of work across the globe regarding the electricity storage. But also, I think what John mentioned is critically important in the talk is that there is also other ways, such as heat, which you can do with the hot water. And if we had, for example, DC heating systems, then, you know, storing water is, we know how to do it. It's cheap and, you know, effective. So there are other, we would need to look at the kind of this system in a more, from more kind of a whole system perspective. not only electricity, gas, heat, transport, but there will be interactions between them, and making that interaction working is one of the core elements of the new where we need to go if we are to make a transition to lower carbon world in a cost-effective manner.
Just not to beat up the government
too much, but to talk about heat networks is sort of criminal for new developments. It's absolutely unnecessary to design and build houses now which require additional heat over and above the accidental heat that you get from the occupants and the incidental equipment in there. And we did have the opportunity through the Code for Sustainable Homes to do something significant. There were technical problems with Code Level 5 and Code Level 6 and their carbon implications, which could have been sorted out. But for the government to have come back off and abandoned the Code for Sustainable Homes and to abandon the upgrading of the building regulations from 2013 and have nothing to do with the 2016 regulations is a real backward step. It's a real loss of an opportunity because that means that we will now continue to build homes which require additional heating, and then that justifies heat networks, and then we get back into the same old mess that we should be avoiding.
And I'd just add that in terms of storage, I think one of the very strong messages coming from all the presentations was you can't look at the physics and the engineering in one box and the market design in the other. What we're seeing in Germany at the moment, obviously pumped storage, which is well over 99% of the world's storage capacity at the moment, makes its money by taking electricity off peak when electricity prices are relatively low and selling electricity into the wholesale market at peak when prices are high. Now, if your renewables are coming on to such an extent that it's demolishing the wholesale market and demolishing the price at wholesale, which is what they're seeing in Germany, then there's no economic case for storage because you can't make money when the peak and the off-peak price converge at a much lower level. So Germany's seen a whole string of pumped storage schemes being cancelled or mothballed or put off for several years at exactly the point when storage is needed to manage the instability of the system of having more variable renewables. And I don't think markets can deal with this. I take exactly the opposite view, I think, much as it hurts, is that probably we've got to re-centralise some of these views. But that's another debate.
Why should we pay heavily for reducing carbon when the amount that the UK will reduce will be replaced many times over by China and India?
Two questions, if I may. We've heard a lot about smart meters. Fantastic, sounds like a brilliant development, can't wait. But I am concerned about how this technology gets into the hands of the poor. I don't want it to be just another technology that's exclusively for those that are better off, and therefore the poorer have to pay for higher bills. Does the panel want to comment on that? And second point, is it possible to assess what the most powerful driver is here for change? Is it people, is it policy, or is it engineers?
Yeah, like most of the questionnaires, people with questions today, I'm going to make two brief points. The other day, I was watching my television, and I've got one of those satellite systems. I won't say which one it is. But the adverts came on about 10, 15 minutes into the programme. So I thought, oh, what else is on? Because I don't like the adverts. And what I found was the adverts were on every channel at the same time. Okay? So what have we done to ourselves? We've forced everybody to go and make tea at the same time. Right? Now, I know that's a simple and a funny kind of comment because the volumes aren't perhaps that high. But when you think about it, we also all commute at the same time. Our offices are all on at the same time. So while we talk about varying the consumption in our homes, we need to start thinking about how we vary the total consumption across our lives, because that will be an improvement for all the millions of people stuck on the trains every morning at the same time, as well as the consumption that goes with that. And that I think is one of the areas where we can make a much wider benefit. And when we come back also to the storage concept of smoothing the supply, we quite blatantly say, well, we've wasted 25% of that amount. But I ask myself, and I'll ask the panel at the same time, is it better perhaps, to be able to waste 25% of the energy by storing and reusing than to have 50 to 60% surplus supply to cover for the fact that we're not going to waste 25% of the energy by storing it. Does that make any sense?
Yes. Shall we start off with Peter this time?
Why should we do it when China and India might not? Actually, we should recognise a number of things. One is that we're in the bind that we're in around climate change as a result of historic CO2 emissions from the industrialisation of the West, which we have done at the expense of the developing world. So it would be rich in the extreme for us to say that we will now carry on a business as usual in our patch because we're all going to hell in the same handbasket. If there is to be any kind of international agreement and any kind of international equity, the West has to take leadership. And I have to say that I think it's been amazingly exemplary that governments in the West, to the extent that they have taken a forward-looking view many decades into the future. The fact is that what we do now will have no impact on climate in the next 25 years. It's only after that point that the scenarios in the IPCC report begin to diverge. So we have governments which are constantly being blamed for taking a 3 to 5 year view, suddenly taking decisions which are committing us to the next 50 years of action with punitive performance measures now. We need to do that because we need to demonstrate the leadership that we've perhaps lacked in the past and to get to a position where we can get to international agreement. The strongest emitting countries from the most industrialized and most advanced economies need to lead the way. It's a simple ethical argument. The issue about technology for the poor is really valid. I think an awful lot of the feed-in tariffs and the incentives around renewables have been taken up by the non-poor, if I might put it like that, and paid for through the bills of everybody. So there has been a disproportionate disadvantaging of people in fuel poverty who pay for middle-class solar panels on roofs and wind turbines getting subsidies. And I think there are some significant policy challenges there. And to answer the question about people, policy, and engineers are not leading the way in making decisions. Engineers are providing technical solutions and are not taking a sufficiently broad and broadly based attitude to the way in which they deliver advice to government because they see themselves too much as technical solution providers rather than being responsible members of society who can take a much broader canvas on which to base their opinions. The thing about going to 24-hour working, I guess, is what you're really trying to say. There are social dimensions of that, but anybody who drives around the M25 as regularly as I do will know that peak spreading is already happening extremely effectively. and somewhere like the M25 is used intensively from about 5:30 in the morning onwards. There is a very big spread of activity for the rush hour in the major cities, Manchester, Leeds, London, and so on. So I think that's already happening. I think to take it too much further would have significant social downsides.
Goran, anything to comment? John?
I'd just like to pick up the latest questions on what's driving change, people, politics, or engineers. Well, I think it's blindingly obvious it's politics. And I don't say that in any derogatory way. But if you think about what we're trying to do, we're moving from a position where in the developed world, most people have got highly reliable 24/7 access to energy in all its forms, whether it's electricity or whether it's fuel for your cars or whether it's gas for your heating system. If it's not there, you're sort of quite taken aback and a bit grumpy. And if it's not there for more than an hour, you become extremely grumpy. And if it's not there for a couple of days, actually, governments usually are at risk. If you think about what we're seeking to do, we're seeking to get to a point where we offer exactly the same functionality you've got now, but differently, at a higher price and with less convenience. So there are very, very few people. There are some people. There are very few people that are out there on the streets demanding that we do that for reasons. So this is politics with both a big and a small P, in my view. We do it in a situation where, in spite of many claims that have been made over the last 40 years, we are in a world that has got as much hydrocarbon available as we want to use. The reserves of hydrocarbons, the accessible reserves, are now greater than they were by a factor of three compared with when I was a student. When I was a student, I was told that petrol and oil will run out within 40 years. But that's all right, because within 30 years, we'll have nuclear fusion power and we won't need it. So we've now got to the point where we're still saying it's going to be 40 years when the oil and the gas and everything else runs out. But experience has shown us that doesn't seem to ever change. It's a moving horizon. Equally, I've got to say that experience has shown us that nuclear fusion is always 30 to 40 years in the future. And the one other point that I wanted to pick up on was also your question about the smart meters. It's very important. Hopefully with smart meters, it won't be a matter of how well off you are, whether you get one. The real question will be, are you going to be in a position to use it to your advantage? And I think somebody, it was probably Peter, said, I, on my house, have got a solar PV system. I was fortunate to be able to afford to buy it when the feed-in tariffs were quite good. It's now a very lucrative revenue generator for me, and I'm very conscious that the revenue is coming from the people in the council estate down the road that couldn't afford to buy one, who are having a levy put on their bills. So there is a real social justice element of this that we've got to keep aware of.
I agree with this. Although there is, regarding the fuel poor, there is new suppliers who are entering the energy field who want to challenge the present Big Six, as it were, because fundamentally there isn't huge amounts of, in terms of what it is for the consumers in here. Who is looking after consumers? And there is, as I say, there is some of these new supply companies who are, in fact, trying to include fuel poor to get to reduce their bills. But at the same time, if you like, making money out of this, there is somebody who is looking after consumers and there is a share of the benefits. Because at present, the feel is that the present industry is looking after themselves, not the consumers.
I wonder why we have such hardly any in-river hydro generation in this country. It must be relatively inexpensive. A decent amount of generation is possible with, at a weir, for example, a metre and a half minimum, and a lot of weirs are higher than that. Our main rivers do vary a little bit in their flow, but generally speaking, they're constant 24 hours a day throughout the year. They wouldn't do anything for flexibility, but my goodness, if we had a lot of them spread across the country, so it's not like centralised generation, but it would be distributed generation, surely they could make quite a difference to the base load. And if we didn't need that base load, you just switch them off, but they still run anyway.
I'd like to quote, if I may, Kevin Anderson, who's from the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change. Analysis concludes that even a slim chance of keeping below a 2 degree centigrade rise now demands a revolution in how we both consume and produce energy. Such a rapid and deep transition will have profound implications for the framing of contemporary society and is far removed from the rhetoric of green growth that increasingly dominates the climate change agenda. That's his words. My words are to substantially agree with that. And I think that as engineers, we are not being honest enough with the public about the extent to which we have to change a world which has been designed for use of fossil fuels for a world designed without it. We still talk of green aviation, we still talk of electric cars, we still talk of smart cities and smart metering. We need to be more honest with the public about the extent of change that will be needed.
I'd like to step back and look at a broader picture, and that is a question of public understanding and being honest with the public. And one of the things in this room is that we're all engineers, or we come from that sort of background. You're well aware that we can't sustain the sort of development that you've been talking about and the sort of thinking unless we have more engineers and we close this enormous gap. And I'd like to see or have your comments on how, as well as the social changes and technological choices in front of us, we manage to encourage more young people to come into STEM, noting that for the last 10 years, with all the efforts, we've actually not moved the needle at all.
Carbon capture and storage has been mentioned almost in passing in several of the addresses. If that could be made to work, it might provide a considerably greater flexibility in the choices and timing of the replacement of power stations and would allow us to go on using fossil fuels for longer. Does the panel think that that technology is actually capable of achieving its objectives?
Goran, do you want to start off with both the questions and any sort of final comment you'd like to make, or perhaps a single message you'd like to leave the audience with?
Regarding the carbon capture and storage, I'm not a kind of technologist expert, so I'm not quite sure what is. But what I've done, I've tried to test, several years ago with BP and Shell, for example, saying if the gas is to be part of low carbon, we need to do CCS. And why don't you demonstrate? Because you are sitting on a big piles of cash. Can you make this technology, make demonstration project to reassure us that this can be done in a reasonable way with reasonable costs so that the CCS can work? When we now look at their scenarios, this is what we also asked the government and the Climate Change Committee. When they give us scenarios, they've got CCS in there. And when we talk to Shell and BP, they say there will be no CCS at all before 2040. So it's quite, I don't know what, whether you, it's quite, as I say, it's very difficult to see what's going on in there. So as I say, just it's a controversial topic still. Regarding the water, there is, I think, I agree with you that there is a big potential in there. Again, I do not have a full picture of this, but I did just heard about one or two examples of this, and there was quite a lot of opposition in the local communities where these things were potentially proposed to be built. And that may be just an exception, but that certainly was there. But you reminded me about, again, kind of this whole system perspective. There is lots of, for example, now development and refurbishment and replacement of our water infrastructure, supplying the water. And what kind of we found that if you look at, there is kind of lots of reservoirs and pumps in there. It looks like a, pump hydro scheme, but we have not linked development of water infrastructure with the fact that we are going to actually now be building electricity systems with nuclear and potentially wind and solar. And if we develop this in a holistic fashion, by spending a little bit more money on the water system, we will be actually able to make our energy system more effective. And that's, again, that was never kind of in the past was as linked as it is now. And going forward, we are going to probably miss a big opportunity if we now refurbish our water system without looking into how that should be linked with the bigger picture, with the energy system development.
Thank you. John, final comments and any answers.
Okay, very quickly. In terms of run-of-the-river schemes, yes, of course, we could do that. You're absolutely right. There are tens of thousands of opportunities. The best estimate is that it might contribute about an extra 5% towards the UK's overall electricity demand because of the average scale of the demand and the effective output of what you might put in. And the challenge, therefore, is how much does it cost to put one of those in? Who's going to put it in? Is there a wire you can connect it to somewhere near your river? And when you run all those things in, does each of the schemes actually offer a good investment for anybody? So I think that's an important element to it. And that sort of feeds on to the question about do we need more people to go into engineering? Well, I mean, you know what we're going to say, don't you? Of course we do. We're engineers. But nevertheless, there are challenges. And I would like to just finish with two points. Carbon capture and storage, can it be made to work? Well, not only can it be made to work, it is working. There's a power station in Saskatchewan called Boundary Dam that operates as a coal-fired power station with carbon capture and storage that's pumped into the ground and used to enhance oil recovery from an oil well. The question of does it work is, long since answered. You can go down to Texas and you can find companies that will give you a fixed price for a carbon capture and transport system to bolt on the back of a power station. The problem is that it more than doubles the capital cost of the power station and it knocks 10 percentage points off the efficiency of the power station. So the issue is it's not affordable because you can't actually compete when you use one. So the challenge is to make some system that captures carbon affordable. And that's very often what all these things come down to. Can it compete with the incumbent technologies? We go back to the comment about politics, but I'll finish, if I may, by the challenge about are we telling the public clearly enough what all this will mean, picking up the quote from Kevin Anderson. In 2010, the Royal Academy of Engineering convened an absolutely superb expert panel. In fact, I was on it, doesn't affect that, but... but they did a report called Generating the Future. And they said, if we're going to meet the 2050 targets, what is our electricity system going to look like? And they finished that report by saying, if we are to achieve this end, it will require the biggest peacetime transformation ever seen in Western Europe to do it. So I think the point is well made. I think we do understand it. That point has been made at a number of fora. This is a major issue. And it's not going to be simply substituting components. It will be a change in the system. But the only thing is, I don't know what the system change is like. And that is the big challenge. We've heard many references tonight to scenarios. Scenarios are guesses about the future. They're not predictions. And all of the scenarios and the optimizations are based upon what do we think the world will be like in 15, 20, 25 years' time. And I will finish with my one comment. Think back 30 years to what the world looked like and how much of today could you have predicted? How much of today's cost could you have predicted? Sat-nav systems, mobile phones, streaming internet over Wi-Fi, over outside. Would you have seen any of that? Would you have guessed what the cost of those things would be? I mean, I remember buying a 60 megabyte storage unit to use at work in the early 80s for £26,000. Right? You wouldn't even consider a mobile phone that's only had that much storage, would you?
Thank you.
That's our challenge.
I'll leave Peter till last because he's got a train to catch.
Yes. So I'll definitely be brief. I think we need to recognise that continuing to serve demand as if it were an immutable objective is out of date and unacceptable. We need to know what the marginal cost of providing the last 5% of reliability is, because if it's doubling the cost of supply, we should rethink whether we actually can afford to meet demand in such a slavish way. And maybe we need to have fundamental societal change to say, the delivery of electricity particularly is not something that you can rely on, and then you start to have a whole new relationship with the electricity that you acquire. And the last thing to say is that, of course, we need more young engineers to come into the professions, but we will not attract the right sort of people in the right sort of numbers if we continue to educate engineers in the narrow, single-minded way that we do traditionally and up to date. We have to accept that if we want engineers to participate in society in the way in which we think that they have a significant contribution to make, they need to be more broadly educated. We need to attract a more broad spectrum of people who are attracted into the profession, and we need to accept that we're going to have to re-engineer the way in which we educate them and then form them into chartered and professional engineers.
Thank you, Peter. Just to sum up briefly before we take the opportunity to thank our speakers again. In another part of my life, I've been a member of my local council for the last 20-odd years, and I spend roughly equal times trying to explain to my political friends what science and technology is about, and trying to talk to my science and technological friends what politics is about, because neither of them gets the other, and actually each of them has a rather jaundiced view. Because actually, most politicians go into it because they want to make a difference and they want to make the world better. And most scientists and technologists are people who care about the same things as the political establishment did. But I think, going to the last point that Peter made there, this gap, the two cultures, I mean, C.P. Snow was writing in the 50s about this, that somehow, and again, it seems to be something that's particularly bad in England, I think. I don't think it's quite as bad in the other countries of the UK and in many of our friends overseas. But this separating out of the sort of legal economic and financial communities at one stage, and the scientific technological, and they hardly ever speak to each other, and they just view each other with a lot of suspicion, I don't think is the way forward. The really refreshing thing, and I can absolutely get why you call it a prestige seminar, is the level of realism and the level of recognizing that despite all of our wishes, we still work with a real world that behaves in a certain way. My fear about, or my belief about Energiewende in Germany, is its whole legislative basis is that Chancellor Merkel needs to repeal the second law of thermodynamics for it to work. It's not the silliest thing she's put before her parliament, but it's continually hearing. I mean, it seems to me self-evident. If we are seriously talking about going back to plundering the operation of nature for our energy, then we're going to massively damage nature. That's obvious, probably unsustainably. I've been reading this week about the niobium mines in China that produce the niobium and sadly a huge amount of cadmium with it for the solar panels that the Chinese are building. Thousands of deaths from this. And although the sun is free, it's certainly not sustainable in putting together the kit that can actually capture the sun. And I think the point I got to in the book really was that I'm not sure how we would go forward, but there's certain things we have to abandon before we've got any chance of going forward. There are certain myths out there that almost, in the words of a very famous song, we kept the best till last in energy. We chose to use all the really nasty ones first and kept the wonderfully easy ones till the last. I won't embarrass you by asking this as a kind of quiz question, but does anyone know when the first electricity was generated in a solar cell, for example? Rashad, that was 1884. The first electricity generated using wind was 1887. The first use of hydrogen as a storage mechanism to use electricity to try and store it, 1890s. Geothermal energy, 1904. Wave power electricity, 1910. All of these things had that same massive amount of enthusiasm poured onto them as everything else that was emerging in the 1890s, the 1900s, the telephone, the motor car, hydropower had poured into them. And they all died suddenly in the 1920s and 1930s when grids came along, when Roosevelt's New Deal rural electrification in the States, the national grid in the United Kingdom. We tried localised generation of electricity, and as soon as the alternative of large point sources became realistic, it died away. Now, we might be able to find ways around that by the smart technology that we've heard about tonight, but the idea that that is very simple, the idea that we haven't thought of energy efficiency before, and that's going to answer the questions, that thank heavens we invented the jumbo jet, because if it wasn't for that, we'd still be doing 15 billion miles of passengers each year, but we'd be doing them in World War I biplanes. Imagine the amount of energy we'd be using then. Or maybe we wouldn't be doing any flying at all, and improved energy efficiency has actually been the single biggest driver for increased energy use in our economy up to this point of time. And again, it's refreshing, and we heard it tonight, that the concept of rebound effects is just beginning to get onto the thing. Even that the European Union now recognises that rebound effects are real, and in some cases can be more than 100%, probably not in developed economies. We have to abandon those myths that there's a simple answer out there and recognise that however we do go forward, it's going to be enormously tough. It's going to be tough technologically, tough environmentally, and tough economically. And that goes back, I think, very much to that point, that there does need to be a degree of honesty about the debate, and it has to be done in such a way in democracies that we bring people with us as well. Because if something is not socially and politically sustainable, it's not sustainable. It doesn't matter how good it is technically or economically. And so I thought a number of those issues were there. I think we are moving towards talking about grid-level costs of electricity instead of just grid parity, which is just a meaningless phrase. We're recognising that that intermittency does lead to huge costs on the system, and we need to find a way of reflecting those costs and managing them rather than falling down this simplistic view, as we've heard tonight, that levelised cost is just completely meaningless when it comes to looking at the actual effects are in our pocket. And if we lie about that, if we pretend that renewables aren't going to massively increase or nuclear are not going to massively increase our costs, then we will lose people at a very early stage when those bills start going up. So I thought it was fascinating tonight. I think we've got three really excellent speakers bringing out that sense of realism, but also a sense of vision and hope. And I think that's the combination that we all need to. And I just think we should thank our speakers in the normal way. I've got four very final comments. Firstly, please complete the evaluation forms in your packs. You won't be allowed out of the building until you've done so. There is a continuing professional development form in the pack. You can get that signed by any members of the committee. They're the ones wearing the green name badges. Next year's seminar on the 9th of November 2016 will be entitled Crossrail, and it will talk about the construction works, the stations, the trains, and the reasons for the delay, I presume. Given that this seminar's concerned with sustainability, the Easter would like just a quick show of hands as to whether people would be prepared in future to have to abandon the idea of a paper delegate pack and to have everything sent to you for electronic devices. Who would be in favour of that? Who would be against? I think that's pretty, with apologies, I think that's pretty overwhelmingly that the answer is yes. So, well, again, thanks for having me, as it were. I'll just pass you on to Daniel Kenning from the Advisory Board to close the meeting.
Thank you all. Thank you very much. It's a trick of LinkedIn that I'm on the advisory board member of the Centre for Sustainable Design. That's my most recent client. I'm actually here to thank everybody, because over a year ago, or until a year ago, I was the chair of the sustainability group at IMEC-E, representing 19,500 mechanical engineers with an interest in sustainability. And what I'm thanking these people for is answering the question, how sustainable is our energy consumption? And we were very pleased when Easter approached us to collaborate on this event, because our group focuses on the big challenge that, as Einstein said, you can't solve the problem with the same thinking that caused the problem in the first place. So we asked our speakers to talk about demand reduction, supply and the integration of the two across all forms of energy in a sustainable manner. And I would just remind us, for those here, that sustainable means meeting the needs of today without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. So there's an intergenerational responsibility there. So that's why we're here. I'd like to thank Malcolm Grimston for chairing the event so well, so fluidly, so entertainingly. Thank you. I'd like to thank our host, Professor John Senior, I can't see where he is now, for letting this event happen in this fantastic facility here. And also the technical team at the university who've organised the streaming of the event online, especially with the two sponsors, Global Teleports and SES Satellites, and all the other supporters of EASTA and the university here. Especially, of course, I'd like to thank our speakers, Professor Peter Guthrie, Professor John Loughhead, and Professor Goran Strabec. We're very, very privileged to have three such eminent speakers. So thank you very much, all three of you. In particular, I'd just like to look at the shape of the three presentations in relation to all of our work in the IMEC-E Sustainability Group. Firstly, Peter, you looked at demand reduction, and you made a very good point there about how we have a collective responsibility. I understand that as meaning we as engineers can't say the politicians have got to solve the problem. We as engineers can't say that the economists have got to solve the problem. We as engineers have got to solve the problem. So we, in this room, our responsibility is to provide alternatives that do work. So thank you for that. John, I do apologise. I think you got the hardest slot, because by asking you to look at supply on its own, you might have been wanting to integrate more with the others. If you look at supply on its own, that's really the unanswerable question. We can't keep supplying more and more and more to meet demand. And I just thought there were a lot of problems that you were highlighting in your talk. So I apologise for that, but it was very good anyway. But it makes the shape of the whole event. And then finally, Goran, your talk about joining these up together and the different thinking that can do that was amazing. And I thought your comment that engineers can do much bigger magic than create low carbon energy systems was very true. Very true. I think we as engineers, if we look for the solutions, we can do that. So I'd urge everybody to take away the learnings from this evening into your own lives and take up your own responsibility and keep up the good work. And to our speakers and to everybody who's helped make this happen, thank you very much indeed.